unnecessary and unacceptable. While this alienated some of Coulter's supporters, the airline's boldness won it rare positive attention. Vox's Matthew Iglesias summed up the reaction. "I can't believe Ann Coulter has managed to make normal people sympathize with a Big Three airline." Whether an organization is creating, chasing, or embracing a storm, some lessons stand out. For one, urgency matters. Research on crowdfunding shows that deadlines are everything. Most funds raised in crowdfunding campaigns are in the final 72 hours. We've seen many despondent movement builders or crowdfunders discover that people really do come through if you give them a deadline and communicate a sense of urgency. David versus Goliath tales are ideal fodder for crowd building, as are crises that threaten the most deeply held values of the community. Defeats matter too. In 2013, when Airbnb lost a big legal battle on the rights of hosts who are renters to use the service in New York, it dramatized that moment to rally hosts around the country and explain the long-term challenge it faced. It sees that loss in New York as a critical milestone in its work to mobilize hosts to personally lobby in the face of regulatory roadblocks. Storms can end up as light drizzles too. And that's okay. Hazare only stumbled onto missed calls after trying short codes. Less than 10% of GetUp's actions accounted for more than half of its member growth in the early years. A new power community that is growing successfully often has a small, incremental growth rate that ticks along month to month, year to year. What are the implications of a world in which movements are everywhere and everyone wants one of their own? We are witnessing the rise of we-washing, a phrase coined by our friend Lee Sean Huang to describe the way brands like Pepsi are using the language of the crowd without having any meaningful interest in engaging with it. As the skills of building a crowd become more widely shared, the public realm is increasingly becoming a kind of Hunger Games for organizations and brands, with each trying desperately to get the storms headed in their direction. In this contest, those who are most rewarded will often be those who stand out, the loudest, the funniest, the most provocative, the most daring. This won't always produce the best social outcomes or the most thoughtful debates. This dynamic can get creepy and problematic quickly. Witness the sorry tale of Baltimore's Mike Martin, who built a huge following with his Daddy-O-5 videos on YouTube, off the back of the ever more cruel pranks he and his wife Heather played on their children. In one video, the parents sprayed invisible ink on their son's bedroom floor, then screamed at him for 5 minutes as he sobbed. In another, the son was encouraged to slap his sister in the face. Mike and Heather ended up losing custody of the children after other YouTubers rallied to protect the kids from abuse. In their belated mea culpa video, Heather explains how their tactics ratcheted up in their quest for an ever bigger crowd. "Once people started watching us, we went from something that wasn't so bad, and then we just kept going more and more for the shock factor to see what could get more views." But in this world of constant recruitment, the most effective crowd builders will be those who are able to move people up the participation scale and sustain and nourish a community over the longer term, dealing with the many challenges, compromises, and balancing acts that requires. That critical capacity is the topic of our next pair of chapters. Chapter 5. What makes new power communities work, and why they sometimes don't. Think of the following graphic, a triangle circumscribed by a circle. This isn't some kind of occultist symbol or anarchist creed de coeur. It's a framework that we will unpack in this chapter and the next to help us understand how new power communities work. Many of today's new power platforms are as economically powerful as megacorporations and as populous as many nations. Our daily lives and our livelihoods are wrapped up in them. So it's vital to understand how they work, the roles we play within them, and the impact they are having on society. In this chapter, we'll explore the roles and dynamics that unfold within these communities, what makes them thrive, what makes them fracture, What makes them fizzle? In the next one, we'll look at what happens when they interact with, and in some cases collide with, the wider world. We begin our study with the tale of a new power community that fell badly out of sync. The story of the hashtag Reddit Revolt. Dear Reddit, you are starting to suck. The post came from QGYH2, a dedicated Reddit user. Previously, he had been responsible for the highest scoring post in the site's history when his message titled Test Post, Please Ignore, triggered the rebellious instincts of the Reddit community who cheekily and en masse denied his request. But now, he was fed up. He ticked off his complaints. Reddit had gotten rid of good staff who cared about the community. It had hired the wrong people. It had started to ignore its users. For him, Reddit had lost its way, prioritizing corporate interests over all else. Reddit, when your investors sit in their special cave and count their money, they list Reddit.com as their main asset here. Reddit.com is not your main asset. Reddit's users and community are your main asset. He cautioned Reddit to learn from the fate of Dig, an earlier online community which imploded when its users jumped ship. And he concluded simply, "So please stop being a dick and get your act together. Thank you, Q." On July 4th weekend in 2015, the 9th most popular website in the United States ground to a halt. Server issues? A malfunctioning cloud? A cyber attack? None of the above. The cause was user mutiny. The hugely popular social sharing site Reddit describes itself as the front page of the internet. Its premise couldn't be more new power. Users share links they find elsewhere on the internet and then upvote their favorite content, or downvote what they don't like, essentially curating their own website with almost no editorial interference. It is in many ways the anti-New York Times. More than 21 million votes are cast each day. To put that in context, 1 week of voting on Reddit chalks up more votes than a US presidential election. It is a huge engine of participation. The building block of each Reddit post is a piece of content served up by users to delight, outrage, move, or provoke. An image of 40 types of pizza. A video of policemen meditating. An interesting question like, what one thing only happens in your country? If you're not one of Reddit's more than 200 million monthly users, you might not realize that many of the memes, videos, and ideas that drift in and out of your social media stream and increasingly shape our popular culture started on Reddit, probably a few days before they hit Facebook or your local TV news. Reddit also has a big impact on politics. Research has shown that Reddit was one of the most important online spaces for alt-right Trump supporters to congregate and coordinate as they successfully waged the so-called meme wars on social media during the 2016 elections. The site is much more than a race to the top anarchic free-for-all. In fact, Reddit is very carefully structured. It is divided up into subreddits, areas for people to discuss and engage around specific topic areas. There are over 1 million of them, ranging from those you might expect, like R Climate Change or R The Donald, for fans of the president, to a remarkably active group devoted to sharing images of morbidly beautiful things, R Morbidly Beautiful. Crucially, the site doesn't have control over those subreddits. They are run by volunteer moderators from among its users. This structure gives Reddit's users, and in particular its moderators, remarkable agency compared to, say, the control Facebook exercises over what people see and engage with. Moderators are in charge of setting direction and shaping discussions with a wide range of tools and choices placed in their hands. The Reddit rules, such as they are, prevent illegality or manipulation of the voting system. But other than that, it is up to the moderator. Imagine Reddit as the Wild West of the internet, with the moderator acting as bartender and sheriff. In addition to the moderators, the mods as they are known, the Reddit world is made up of its users, who skew young, male, and geeky, and do the upvoting, linking and commenting, and its admins, the Reddit Inc. paid staffers, who are charged with making the Reddit community thrive and with advancing the interests of Reddit Inc., goals that, as we'll discuss, are not always compatible with each other or with those of the community. One of the most popular subreddits is the Ask Me Anything AMA thread, where everyone from Barack Obama to Bill Gates takes questions from the Reddit community. As we write this, a 90-something German woman is starring in an AMA about her experiences as a nurse during World War II. It's the second most popular thread right now on Reddit, coming in just ahead of a discussion about criminal justice reform and a link to a skit about Beyoncé on Saturday Night Live. Victoria Taylor joined Reddit Inc. in 2013 as communications director. She then became director of talent, overseeing over 2,500 AMAs and serving as the company's interface with many of its most important moderators. She was beloved by the mods, who saw her as more than just an enforcer on behalf of Reddit Inc., but as something more like a friend. When my wife got pregnant, she sent us chocolate-covered strawberries in the mail. Just all these little things she would do for everybody, recounts Brian Lynch, a key moderator on the I am a blank Ask Me Anything subreddit, I am a, and a central node in the Reddit volunteer community. On July 2, 2015, however, Victoria was abruptly fired by Reddit without public explanation. Brian found out when he got a call that holiday weekend saying that there was no admin available to host an I am a. This was the first he'd heard of the dismissal of someone he saw not only as a friend, but as an important ally. For him, and for many other mods, this was an outrage that capped years of deteriorating trust between them and the Reddit platform. They had long suffered broken promises to build features to help them do their jobs better, such as tools to fight spam, and promises of faster response times from administrators. As unpaid but highly valuable volunteers, the mods often felt taken for granted, and saw in Victoria qualities that were otherwise absent in their relationship with Reddit Inc. She made them feel like a priority. She recognized their value. For Brian and his fellow mod, Courtney Swearingen, Victoria's firing was the last straw. So they scrambled the moderator team on a private Slack channel away from the site where the company couldn't track their conversations. And they decided to deploy one of the most symbolic and damaging tools in their artillery. They made their I am a subreddit private in protest, essentially shutting it down. Their idea began to spread. Other mods said, "We'll go black in solidarity with you," recalls Brian. Soon, the major R Science subreddit went dark. Next, R Ask Reddit, the most popular subreddit on the site, shut down. Then after that, it just kind of snowballed where it became the cool thing to do. A rolling blackout of the site's 300-plus top subreddits ensued, and a full-scale rebellion. What quickly had become known as hashtag Reddit Revolt, then Armageddon, was on. Reddit's traffic had been all but annihilated by its own moderators. In the days that followed, the best and worst of Reddit was on display. Reddit's relatively new CEO, Ellen Powell, quickly apologized, recognizing the ignored grievances of the site's moderators. "We screwed up, not just on July 2nd, but also over the past several years. We haven't communicated well, and we have surprised moderators and the community with big changes. We have apologized and made promises to you, the moderators, and the community over many years, but time and again, we haven't delivered on them. When you've had feedback or requests, we haven't always been responsive. The mods and the community have lost trust in me and in us, the administrators of Reddit." Ironically, Powell's mea culpa was thwarted by the democratic logic of Reddit's own homepage. Her post was downvoted over 3,000 times, making it hard for users to even find it. At the same time her apology was disappearing, a change.org petition urging Powell's resignation started bubbling upward on the site, soon gathering more than 200,000 signatures. The petition refers to empty promises to moderators, but it also attacked Powell for something quite different. Reddit's new age of censorship. Taylor's firing, it turned out, had brought to a boil a full range of tensions simmering in the Reddit community. In the months prior to the revolt, Pau had been attempting to create new rules to shut down offensive content and hate speech on the site. Predictably, this had clashed with the somewhat outlaw libertarian ethos of Reddit. Many suspected that her efforts were not driven by a moment of moral awakening, but rather were an effort to clean up the site so it could be more easily monetized for advertisers in one of the great ironies of our era, the parent company of this anarchic online community is Condé Nast. The speech that Pau was targeting was extreme. She was seeking to ban revenge porn, a form of online abuse predominantly targeting women and subreddits like r/transfag, a poisonous forum mocking and attacking transgender people. r/shitniggerssay, one of several racist and white supremacist threads on the site. And r/fatpeoplehate, which had over 5,000 subscribers at the time it was closed down. The ban was framed as an anti-harassment policy and was directed at moderators who weren't effectively policing their own communities. We will ban subreddits that allow their communities to use the subreddit as a platform to harass individuals when moderators don't take action. The users whom Pau sought to silence made up a very small part of the overall community. Reddit co-founder Steve Huffman estimated them as the toxic 0.2% of Reddit, polluting the space for everyone else. But far more than 0.2% of Reddit's users were turning against Ellen Pau. The backlash against the ban was not solely about the issues at hand, but became a larger statement of protest against the cultural impositions of Reddit on its community. In a space where new power values of openness and freedom were deeply cherished, the old power diktat, however well justified, was always going to land hard. But there was something else going on too. It was also easy to sense gender dynamics at play on a platform whose users were mostly male. Pau was no low-profile new hire. She was the woman who had just famously sued her former employer, blue-chip venture capitalist firm Kleiner Perkins, for gender-based discrimination. The language of the Change.org petition had more than a hint of misogyny. It cites the lawsuit and refers to Pau as a manipulative individual who will sue her way to the top. And in the days that followed, Pau was subjected to the very online harassment she had sought to ban on the platform, including death threats from Reddit's users and vicious personal attacks, some of them sexually and racially charged. By July 10th, a week after Armageddon had begun, and amid increasing concerns that Reddit users would begin fleeing en masse to other services, the very dynamic that Reddit had benefited from when its rival site Digg suffered a mass desertion in 2010, Pau resigned. A user revolt had toppled the leadership of a major internet platform, and Huffman, the Reddit co-founder, was asked to step back in as CEO to save a new power community in crisis. So who does what? Understanding the structure of a new power community. How did it come to this? And what can Reddit's travails teach us about how to build and sustain an effective new power community beyond its initial surge? Any new power community has three key actors: its participants, its super participants, and the owner or stewards of the platform. Think of these as three corners of a triangle. The platform owner or platform steward. The company, Reddit Inc., is the platform owner for Reddit. It sets the overarching rules. It owns the brand's IP and pockets the ad revenue. Victoria Taylor worked for Reddit Inc. To take some other examples, Airbnb's platform owner is Airbnb Inc. Facebook's is Facebook Inc. And in effect, Mark Zuckerberg himself, who retains effective control of the company. Likewise, Wikipedia, which might feel ownerless to its users, is in fact governed and controlled by a board with the power to fundamentally alter its superstructure and rules, something its volunteer editors and users can't do. Platform owners have the ability to control, or at least substantially influence, who is allowed to participate in the platform, its governance and decision-making, how value is distributed, and even whether the platform lives or dies. Some new power communities don't have any person or entity that meets this definition of owner. Instead, those communities have what we call platform stewards, who play recognizable but sometimes informal leadership roles that allow them to channel the energy of the broader community, create rules or norms, and define the structure of a platform. Even the most radically decentralized models, like the virtual currency Bitcoin, have seen such figures emerge. Though anyone is free to take Bitcoin's code, adapt it, and create a new protocol for others to follow, only a handful of people have the power to commit code to the Bitcoin codebase. These few have played a stewardship role in directing the technology. A similar function is played by the heads of decentralized terrorist networks like Al-Qaeda. Its top leaders are not necessarily directing the activities of individual cells, but they have the ability to set rules, norms, such as they are, and the general direction of the network, even if they can't be described as genuine owners. Super participants. The energy of a new power community is driven by its super participants, the most active contributors to the platform, and often those who create the core assets that power the platform and create its value. In the case of Reddit, the super participants are the moderators, people like Brian and Courtney, who shape much of the content and conversation on the platform and contribute to the development of the community's norms. For Airbnb, the super participants are the hosts who offer their properties online. The super participants for Uber are the drivers. For Wikipedia, the super participants are the editors who create and improve its content. As the most engaged users and those who contribute the most, and who often have the most to lose, super participants are some of the most influential voices inside a new power community. Participants. Finally, participants are the people who take part in a new power platform and tend to form the vast majority of its users. For Reddit, these are the readers, voters, and sharers of content. For Airbnb, it is the guests. For Facebook, it is anyone with a profile. For Uber, it is the riders. In the terms of the participation scale, participants generally take part by consuming, sharing, adapting, affiliating, and funding, but not by producing assets or playing an organizing role in the way that super participants do. The great challenge of the new power community is to weigh the needs of the three different groups, which can easily fall into conflict. The Reddit revolt was the result of a critical failure of balance in the Reddit community. Reddit Inc. had underinvested in its super participants for years before the revolt, sowing the seeds for the events of that summer. When Reddit introduced self-moderated groups in 2008, it unleashed a huge surge of agency that became the lifeblood of the platform. Brian recalls why he chose to become a volunteer moderator when the site introduced them. "You got to build a community. You build a policy structure that keeps it thriving, keeps it going. That's why Reddit was successful. You feel like you own it." But in empowering its moderators, Reddit also allowed them to create their own fiefdoms, some of which became bigger than most single-purpose websites, with hundreds of thousands or millions of users in an individual subreddit. These factions had the potential to challenge the platform from within. Courtney talks about her identity as a super participant like this. "Reddit is my community center. It's my YMCA. Moderators like Courtney or Brian weren't demanding money or credit, but they wanted to be supplied with the tools to do their job better and to be treated with respect by the administration. They asked for simple things like updates to their modmail, the internal message tool that moderators use to manage their groups. For years, those requests went largely unheeded by the platform, and the relationship between Reddit Inc. and its super participants gradually deteriorated. The tension between Reddit Inc. and the moderators was the backdrop for Powell's effort to ban the most offensive behaviors from the site. And the hashtag Reddit Revolt brought it all to a head. The platform was battling with its users and its moderators. The moderators had locked out users. Users were at odds with each other. It was quite the mess. The Reddit story is a dramatic version of the tensions that new power communities manage every day. The needs of platform owners, super participants, and participants are often not aligned, and sometimes clash directly. Think of Twitter, which has been challenged because its super participants, the influential super users who dominate the platform, love its quirky functionality and culture. While those same qualities prevent growth among the vastly larger market of everyday participants, many of whom find Twitter noisy, confusing, and nasty. To dig into these dynamics a bit more deeply, let's turn to the sharply contrasting ways that Uber and Lyft, two ride-sharing apps with very similar businesses, are managing their new power communities. This juxtaposition tells us a lot about the connections among platforms, super participants, and participants, and the factors that can bring them closer together or drive them farther apart. Organizing pickets versus organizing picnics. The big difference between Uber and Lyft. The battle of Uber versus Lyft has become the Coke versus Pepsi of the new power economy. The two companies are both chasing the same drivers and riders. They live in fierce and unfriendly competition, with Uber well ahead, having scaled much faster and expanded globally, leading to a valuation over 10 times that of Lyft, but with Lyft posing a real threat in some of Uber's biggest markets. The functionality of the two platforms is very similar. An Uber user feels thoroughly at home with the Lyft app and vice versa. But from the beginning, Uber and Lyft have positioned themselves very differently. Uber launched as everyone's private driver, the pitch being that you too could slink into the back of a badass shiny black ride. Lyft came to life as your friend with a car, with a giant pink moustache amiably perched on the grill, riders hopping in the front seat and fist bumping the driver a hello. Over time, Lyft has mostly ditched the moustaches and the fist bumping, but still positions itself as trying to get closer to its drivers and its riders. Uber is defined by its remoteness, with a cutthroat bro culture that has created a toxic relationship with its key constituents and led to the downfall of founder and CEO Travis Kalanick. A typical comment from Kalanick, anticipating driverless cars, summed up the company's attitude, casting its drivers as little more than a cost center. The reason Uber could be expensive is because you're not just paying for the car, you're paying for the other dude in the car. Yet the Uber story goes much deeper than the personal failings of Kalanick. The culture he enabled and represented came to define the company. To see these different approaches at work, let's consider the ways the two platforms went about implementing rate cuts at the start of 2016. A decision that gave riders cheaper fares, but squeezed drivers hard. How to cut fares and influence drivers. It all began when Uber suddenly announced it was cutting its rates in 80 cities across the United States, anywhere from around 10 to over 20%. This was welcome news for riders, but not for drivers. As Harry Campbell, who runs the popular blog The Rideshare Guy, observed, in true Uber fashion, they made the announcement after business hours on a Friday and didn't even email drivers about it. Uber knew best, so Uber set new rules. Its argument was that the cut was a critical measure to drive demand during the slow winter months. It claimed that, statistically speaking, the driver would earn more owing to increased demand. Of course, this logic was not immediately attractive to the driver who used to receive $43.67 to get to LaGuardia Airport from Manhattan and would now receive $37.12. Uber was taking a classic old power approach, a decision by fiat handed down to drivers with no warning or consultation, delivered with a seminar in how they might better understand their own best interests. Across the country, reactions from drivers included strikes, protests, and threats of boycotts. Lyft, weighing a response to Uber's price cut, had a decision to make. When Uber had made similar cuts in the past, Lyft had not, but it had cost them business. For all the fist bumps in the world, price is the name of the game. As CEO John Zimmer wrote in a message to drivers, Even with our better service, passengers first choose the more affordable option. So Lyft decided to cut fares too, but looked to their driver community to help guide the process. Bringing together a wide range of drivers in San Francisco, Lyft was able to generate a series of initiatives that would mitigate the cost cutting. One idea was to increase the referral fee for drivers securing new passengers. Another was free car washes. A third was to encourage regular meetups for drivers funded by Lyft because the bonds you create with each other strengthen our community too. At the same time that Uber's drivers were turning against the platform to organize pickets, Lyft was helping its drivers organize picnics. Every one of the new initiatives was proudly displayed on the Lyft blog, with a driver credited for each idea alongside testimonials from Lyft riders, celebrating what great human beings Lyft drivers are. As at Round It Rosie wrote, "I love at Lyft drivers because they are artists, bakers, med students, retirees, and the coolest people in LA. Hashtag thank you Lyft driver." While some of this might feel like sugarcoating on a bitter pill, it worked because Lyft's instincts so consistently demonstrated new power values. The platform owners were transparent and open to super participants about the financial challenge they faced. They looked to their network, not simply their senior managers, to find solutions. They created structures to get all three corners of the new power triangle allied in facing the challenge, with incentives for their drivers and the hashtag campaign for their passengers. Inductions and inducements. Rideshare guy, Harry Campbell, has been a driver for both companies. He explained to us that the stark difference in culture between Uber and Lyft plays out broadly in how they manage their drivers. For both firms, the ease of signing up as a driver is touted throughout their networks. Compare the promise of signing up takes less than 4 minutes with the 2 years of deep study of the knowledge needed to become a London taxi driver, a powerful reminder of how our notions of expertise are changing in a new power world. Yet for all the similarity, the firms take a different approach to induction. As Campbell tells us, as a new Lyft driver, you actually have to meet with a mentor. So that's another, more experienced driver, and they'll walk you through the ropes, do a spot check on your car, make sure that you'd basically be a good Lyft driver, and take you on a quick test drive around the block. For Uber, there is no such procedure for bringing new drivers on board. It's all done over email communications, so you can imagine that a lot of new Uber drivers really feel like they're out there on their own. They have no interaction with other drivers. They have no interaction with passengers. They have no interaction with a physical person at the company themselves. They feel like they have to figure these things out for themselves. They don't have co-workers that they can talk to. They don't even have someone at the water cooler because their car is their office. I think that's the sense that you get right from the onset, that Lyft does care. Campbell explains that Uber seems at pains to keep itself at a distance from the lived experience of their drivers. Uber actually had a policy where they don't allow their corporate employees to be Uber drivers, where Lyft is almost the opposite. They highly encourage their employees to be drivers. Lyft tries to show it cares, too, in how it offers drivers incentives. Lyft has always offered riders the opportunity to tip drivers. Uber only introduced this feature in 2017 under pressure from drivers and besieged by crisis. Lyft also takes a different approach to rewarding their most committed drivers, operating a sliding scale that reduces Lyft's commission based on how many hours a driver works. The most dedicated, who chalk up 50 hours a week, basically get your entire commission back. Not so for Uber. These differences have a real impact on drivers, who, according to Campbell, largely prefer to drive for Lyft, as well as an interesting effect on the rider-driver relationship. One of the things that Uber drivers complain about, jokingly amongst drivers, is that when you get to pick up an Uber passenger, they make you wait forever. It's kind of like going off the slogans. Would you make your private driver wait? Yeah, probably. Would you make your friend with a car wait? Maybe not. The power of platform culture. The sum of the relationships between platform, super participants, and participants makes up what sharing economy guru Arun Sundararajan has called platform culture, those shared norms, values, and capabilities among the providers. He sees this as the analogue of a corporate culture, but without the directive authority or co-located social systems that traditional firms can take advantage of to manage their employees. The Lyft story demonstrates some of the critical tactics and philosophies of creating a positive platform culture. It enlists its network participants as allies, or at least signals in this direction. It approaches the world with a human face, not just an algorithmic logic. It is working out ways to align pay and other incentives with a sense of decency and fairness. It invests in getting close to those in its network to better understand their challenges and realities. Most likely, the duel between Lyft and Uber will be settled by the brutal logic of price and convenience. If it takes Uber 3 minutes to match driver and rider, and it takes Lyft 8, then the rider looking to get home and the driver looking to make bank aren't going to be easily swayed by touchy-feely matters of culture and inclusion. But if and when that gap closes, things might start looking very different. There is a big opportunity, too, if either platform starts to do more to truly benefit its drivers. In an effort to shed its evil empire image, Uber is exploring a range of initiatives to sweeten the deal for drivers, including offering them equity in the company. Lyft co-founder John Zimmer is warmly anticipating the fight ahead. If Lyft can begin to match Uber on product, as they are doing in major cities like San Francisco, where they hold almost half the market, then culture becomes a critical differentiator. His biggest advantage may be Lyft's drivers. In a 2017 survey conducted by Campbell, more than 75% of Lyft drivers said they were satisfied with their experience. Less than half of Uber drivers could say the same. Inside the triangle, design choices for new power communities. Uber versus Lyft is a story of design choices. How much agency and value should go to participants? How to recognize and reward super participants, and how to create feedback loops that keep them coming back. Anyone wanting to understand the dynamics of a new power community, or design one for themselves, needs to wrestle with these key questions. Who gets rewarded, and who pays? Incentives and rewards in new power platforms shape whether and how participation occurs. Uber and Lyft attract riders with low prices and fast pickups. They attract drivers with flow of demand and surge pricing. Yet these two dynamics aren't always in sync. When it rains, say, the market shifts, so the sodden father of two now pays 3 times the normal rates to get his whiny kids home and hates the platform every mile of the way, while the delighted and dry driver is now making a morning's take in a couple of hours. The platform must decide how to balance these competing incentives. To take another example, YouTube's partner program shares 55% of the ad revenue coming from a video with its creators. This has made a very small number of young video makers quite rich and created incentives and loyalty and dreams of stardom for a longer tail of super participants on the platform. And Etsy's long-standing commitment to never take more than 3.5% of the revenues raised by their sellers is a brand promise at the heart of managing and engaging their super participants. It can be hard to find the right rewards to drive a new power community. Sometimes a financial incentive gets the right result. Sometimes the sense of being part of something important will deliver more than cash. Often you need the right balance of both. Yelp, for example, initially tried to pay reviewers and found it created a transactional dynamic and weakened loyalty, so they adopted a volunteer community strategy instead. Meetup.com had the opposite experience. Their network allows anyone, anywhere, to set up meetings with others in their neighborhood in person to do anything from practice their French to talk about living with diabetes. When Meetup started, it was free for anyone to start a group, and thousands of events were posted. But what Scott Heiferman, Meetup's founder, quickly found was that the organisers of these free groups were less likely to take their obligations seriously, and sometimes wouldn't even show up to the events they were hosting if they didn't make a financial commitment to being a host. So now, Meetup's primary business model is a modest $10 to $15 per month charged to their super participants to manage a group. It has been the making of the platform. Whether money is in the mix or not, the critical task here is to create incentives that not only don't treat participants like commodities, but also reinforce community norms. The first breakout crowdfunding platform, Kickstarter, figured this out early. Those running campaigns are encouraged to reward backers in creative, generous ways, like inside access to the campaign's creators, that don't map directly to the monetary value of their contributions. As Kickstarter's founders remind their community, Kickstarter is not a store. Who gets recognized and who has status? Recognition systems that validate the work of participants or super participants can be hugely motivational. Think about the power of the validated Twitter user with the big tick next to their name. Or take eBay's Power Seller program, which confers both tangible commercial benefits and a somewhat intangible yet significant community status. Recognition sometimes takes the form of seemingly banal and meaningless online monikers and status bumps, like Snapchat's much-vaunted trophy case. But even these can be highly effective at driving repeat engagement. On Reddit, recognition is conferred using karma points, displayed on every user's profile based on how useful the community has found their links and comments. For the outsider, these points could seem meaningless, but for many Reddit users, they are a big part of why they feel valued and keep coming back. Well-designed, intangible reward systems can confer huge meaning for the individuals who take part in them. The trick is to build status in a way that feels consistent with the ethos of the platform. Uber's VIP program for its most loyal riders feels consistent with that brand's elitism. But for some platforms, creating a virtual caste system might feel inegalitarian. This is especially true for the new crop of digitally driven social movements, where the principle of inclusion and equal voice would clash with efforts to put the most active or valued participants on a pedestal. What creates stickiness? At the heart of every successful new power platform is a great feedback loop. We are all now hooked on them. From multiplayer games to online petition sites, well-designed feedback mechanisms that track our progress and that of our friends and create a drip, drip, drip of dopamine-fueled satisfaction are increasingly central to most modern consumer technology experiences. Think of how the likes or comments on people's Instagram posts keep them coming back. And these aren't just ego boosts. Done right, they can make people feel connected to one another and tied to something bigger than themselves. These feedback loops can become more compelling when there is a time factor or collective goal in play. Think of the urgency of the crowdfunding experience, where you watch your $100 contribution play a role in hitting a $5,000 goal. Or think of the Nike running app, where we can see our own progress and compare ourselves to friends in a potent mix of collaboration and competition. How do you establish trust? Many new power networks simply wouldn't function without the reputation systems that manage risk and incentivize collaborative behavior within them. 10 years ago, if you had described to someone the basic model for Airbnb, that you'd rent your home with all the furniture in it to a complete stranger without meeting him or her, he'd have chuckled heartily. In fact, the celebrated venture capital firm Union Square Ventures famously passed on Airbnb because its partners were skeptical people could ever trust one another enough to do this. But systems that establish reputation and build trust have enabled all kinds of seemingly far-fetched new power models to come to life. By allowing guests and hosts to rate and provide detailed reviews about one another, and by assuming certain risks as the platform owner, what you might think of as centralized trust functions like payment security and identity verification, platforms like Airbnb have been made possible. Exactly how these systems are designed, however, shapes how effective they are. Airbnb realized that because of fear of retaliation and social awkwardness, reviewers were leaving each other much less honest reviews. So in 2015, they changed how reviews worked to have them released simultaneously. So a host's review of a guest wouldn't be shaped by a negative or positive guest review and vice versa. Researcher Tom Slee has found that, before this change, on Airbnb the vast majority of ratings were 4.5 or 5. When we rate each other, ratings become more a courtesy than a judgment. Just as restaurant tips only weakly correspond to the quality of service, so a rating of 4.5 or 5 is more a way of politely concluding an exchange than it is of assessing the behaviour of a host or guest. This is a trend found on other new power platforms, and you'll recognise it in that interaction you have with your Uber driver when he tells you he's giving you 5 stars as you get out of the car, in hopes that you'll feel a moral obligation to reciprocate. There's another important thing to keep in mind about the role of trust and reputation systems in new power models, how they can reinforce existing bias or injustices. Ben Edelman and Michael Luca of the Harvard Business School found that non-black hosts are able to charge approximately 12% more than black hosts for comparable listings, controlling for ratings and other factors. Further research by Edelman, Luca, and Dan Sviersky showed rampant discrimination against black guests. The very system Airbnb had designed to promote trust, using the real names and faces of guests and hosts, allowed implicit bias and plain old racism to cause explicit harm. After a significant public backlash, with black users sharing their experiences alongside the hashtag, #AirbnbWhileBlack, in 2016, the company announced a series of measures to fight this kind of discrimination. But notably, they resisted calls to anonymize names and profile pictures because profile photos are essential to Airbnb's overall mission of building a community. Who calls the shots? When members of the Occupy movement in Zuccotti Park made decisions, they gathered for what they called the General Assembly. Decisions required almost complete consensus among hundreds or even thousands of people via an elaborate system of hand gestures, waggling fingers for agreement, limp wrists to the floor for disagreement, crossed fists for an outright veto on a proposal. At the General Assembly, everything was designed to create a feeling of radical inclusiveness and a sense that every voice was equally valued, not just the loudest or most powerful ones. The people's mic was a tactic used in which the crowd at a General Assembly would repeat what the speaker was saying in short phrases so everyone could hear. Initially created as a workaround because the police had cracked down on the use of megaphones, it came to represent Occupy's ethos of participation and collective action. As social movement theorist Craig Calhoun put it, the human megaphone evoked the decentralized popular nature of the occupation. It made the group a demonstration of participatory democracy. Occupy took an extreme stance on who calls the shots. Namely, everyone. And it ultimately cost them. Andrew Cornell recounts a sympathetic observer of Occupy LA, explaining the loss of momentum there. 3 weeks into the occupation, the group was spending more time discussing its own process than anything else. Many new power communities, especially corporate ones, can tend toward the other extreme, where the platform owners really call the shots, delegating only trivial choices to the masses. Facebook Inc. makes all the big governance decisions, with the average members just able to tinker with their privacy settings and choose from a range of emojis to demonstrate their mood. To show how these vital design choices can play out, we'll finish this chapter with the story of a movement that, in its formative years, got most of these questions right. Building a passionate community and a well-balanced triangle structured with the right incentives and feedback mechanisms. The perfect triangle of invisible children. In a way, it was all Robert Redford's fault. The original plan was simple, sincere, and naive. Return from African adventure in 2003, make a truly compelling documentary, enter the Sundance Festival, become documentary darlings, Meet Redford. Maybe have him introduce them to Clooney. Achieve global superstardom. See the world unite against the savagery of Ugandan warlord Joseph Kony. Bring him down. But Sundance said no. And the three young American founders of Invisible Children, Jason Russell, Bobby Bailey, and Lauren Poole, were stuck. They had a story they felt the world needed to hear. Lives depended on it. Yet they had no distribution. There was no Netflix original programming back then. YouTube was an infant. So, through lack of options as much as anything else, they set out to build their own model. As Ben Kesey, Invisible Children's former CEO, told us, that was our impetus for giving the finger to the system and saying, we're going to build our own distribution, we're going to go right to the audience. Their first movie, Invisible Children Rough Cut, the one that Redford passed on, is the origin story of their movement. It chronicled their trip, with three hip young white men, fresh-faced and surfer preppy, heading to Africa, in search of our story, and finding it as they discovered the atrocities of Joseph Kony, who forcibly enlisted children into his terrorist militia. Many years later, the group would face criticism for positioning themselves as saviors and heroes. But in this first film, they come across as well-meaning, culturally naive doofuses. They went to Sudan and got bored. They blew up a termite's nest for kicks. They killed a snake with a hatchet. They threw up a lot. It was more Hangover Part 2 than I Have a Dream. It is not hard to see why Sundance passed. But it is also not difficult to see why many kids would become so inspired. The movie told an underreported story of a monster on the other side of the world. It showed children sleeping en masse at bus stops to find protection from him in numbers. It was compelling and relatable. For young audiences, it was a story of people like them discovering a cause and then asking other people like them to help. The role of the roadie, how super participants built the Invisible Children network. To get the word out, Invisible Children started to organize small screenings in churches and on campuses. Think of these as mini Sundances, where communities of people would come together around the movie to engage with it, discuss it, and crucially, act on it, offering their voice, funds, and support. The screenings could not offer a huge blast of publicity, but they offered a different kind of value, deep connections to local audiences. For the next 8 years, Invisible Children shaped and perfected this local model. They would typically have two tours a year, where they would debut a new movie or highlight a key campaign. In total, they launched 16 tours, leading to over 13,000 screenings that reached an extraordinary 5 million people. Each of these mini Sundances relied on their own Redford-like figures. Called roadies, these were young people who would pledge 6 months of their lives to volunteering to organize campaigns and screenings. The recruiting video Invisible Children used to attract roadies highlights why the job was so enticing. Telegenic former roadies guaranteed that you're part of something huge and you'll blow their minds, recalling four-to-a-bed sleeping arrangements and even quoting Henry V's St. Crispin's Day speech. It was a promise of agency and meaning, dressed up with a henna tattoo and a wink. The roadies were earnestly trained, taught the history of the conflict in Uganda, given lessons from the civil rights movement, organized in teams of four, and paired with a survivor, often a former child soldier. By the time they finally set out on the road, they had already invested significant time and energy in the events they were planning, and so had their local organizers, whose floors they would often sleep on. All this activity was tracked centrally via a Salesforce database, so roadie teams could see their donations and sales, statistics, compared to other teams, all this internal competition. It was fun, says Kesey. Invisible Children had built smart and transparent recognition systems to help drive the ideal roadie behavior. This is a valuable study of how to engage and develop a super participant. Roadies were highly incentivized and bound together in tight-knit groups by a strong culture. Their job was to build a movement around each local moment, driving engagement, online buzz, and participation. They were invested in each small success, which added up to something bigger than each individual screening. Once the roadie team left town, Invisible Children did not leave people's lives. It cultivated the network of local organisers who had held screenings and used this base of people to organise big national moments like 2009's Rescue event. The Rescue, held on the heels of the latest film release, was designed to unleash the creativity of young supporters activated by the screenings. As Zach Barrows, Invisible Children's movement director, explained to us, "In order for your city to be rescued, you had to have the media show up to cover your event, and you had to have some type of mogul, international or from your community, come out and recognize that this, the kidnapping of children, is in fact happening." This led to 80,000 kids turning out in 100 cities, often accompanied by media-grabbing influencers, to host physical events that were filmed and tweeted to reach many multiples more. To achieve this reach, it helped that many of the Invisible Children's early connected connectors were young evangelical Christians, a highly motivated and closely networked group. All these activations had extraordinary effects on the Invisible Children community. The researcher, Beth Carlin, worked with the group to try to better understand their network, surveying over 2,000 participants from roadies to attendees at screenings. Her findings showed astonishing levels of commitment. Over 90% had talked to friends, family about Invisible Children. 78% had purchased an Invisible Children item. 75% had made a donation. And 42% were part of an Invisible Children club or group. The roadies and organisers had done a remarkable job of cultivating engaged participants. Campus by campus, tour by tour, week after week, Invisible Children had mobilised a nation of young people around an obscure problem on the other side of the world. As Zach Barrow says, it was like you thought of Invisible Children and your first thought was, "I know those people. Those are my friends." It was built on personal connections. These connections had come together in a perfect triangle. Invisible Children had found the right ways to reward, engage, and affirm all their constituents. Yet 8 years in, for all this symmetry and energy, they were facing a fundamental problem. Joseph Kony was still at large. Chapter 6. What makes new power communities work and how they fuse with the wider world. The next 27 minutes are an experiment. Invisible Children was frustrated. It had built a reputation for innovative activism. It was beloved by an army of young people. But for its young founders, the mission would not be complete until Joseph Kony was brought to justice. So, somewhat in desperation, they decided to go in a very new direction. What they needed was a massive burst of fame and publicity. They needed Kony's name everywhere. This, the founders believed, might finally help finish the story they had begun almost a decade ago. Their highly charged but relatively localized campus and school projects just hadn't got the word out widely enough. They decided to put all their efforts and resources behind a new film that they would distribute differently. Instead of using their tried and tested roadie model to launch it, with each local organizer producing events around the content to introduce it to their community, they would release this film direct to market. Their goal was to create a viral sensation. They called this film Kony 2012. They succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. Within a week of its March 5th launch, 100 million people had seen the video, which at almost 30 minutes long defied expectations of what people would watch on a phone or laptop. It was declared the most viral video in history. Surveys suggested that more than half of young American adults had heard of it. Kony 2012 was ambitious, inspiring, and dramatic, hitting every emotional note. It was narrated by the magnetic leader of Invisible Children, Jason Russell, who was featured heavily in the film, even turning the camera on his very cute young son, who joined him in promising to stop Kony. The production values were gorgeous. The cinematic storytelling was worthy of Russell's film school training. The call to action accompanying the video was smart and, at the time, a real innovation. The founders set up a website making it easy to tweet at 20 culture makers and 12 policy makers to use their power for good. They asked the public to call on people like Mark Zuckerberg, Justin Bieber, Bill O'Reilly, and Oprah to help make Kony famous. The video was seeded and propelled by the existing Invisible Children